To start recording. Welcome to our final session on mental health, mind and body. It's been a wonderful series to start the new year, and we're so happy to welcome back Tom Knyer from Samaritan Counseling Guidance Consulting. And I'd also like to remind you that next week, Graham Standish returns with a fascinating series on Christian mysticism, which is something that Presbyterians are often a little bit afraid of. But believe me, Graham knows how to handle it. So it promises to be a great series. And now I'll turn it over to Tom to open us with prayer.
Morning, everyone. We will now turn to the Lord. Lord, it's in the silence that we draw close to you. And so once again, we quiet ourselves to hear your voice to speak to us this morning. We focus once again on caring for ourselves that we might be able to care for others. We know that you've called us to this and that we find our fulfillment in pouring ourselves out for your mission in the service of others. Give us the grace, the courage, the faith, and the confidence to be able to be used by you, to be vessels for your grace, for your honor and glory. We pray in your holy name. Amen. All right. So we're back for more mental health. I want to do a quick review of where we left off. The focus of last week was on self-care, and we asked the simple question whether we needed permission for it, and really the only one that can give permission is us. So give yourself permission to take care of yourself, because self-care covers all the dimensions of our health and well-being, our emotional dimension, our spiritual, our mental, our physical. And by taking care of one, we benefit the others. They all work together. And as I mentioned last week, to give ourselves the resources needed to give of ourselves is our goal. That's really why we do this. Because you can't give what you don't have. We started to cover some of the things that contribute to mental health. We talked about sleep, exercise, and nutrition. And when I start a counseling session, you know, in the intake appointment, I ask specifically, of course, why they have come for counseling. But when I start asking about what's troubling them and so forth, I switch to, so how are you sleeping? And are you eating well? And are you exercising? And sometimes people are a little thrown by that. Why would you be asking me how I'm sleeping? I'm here for counseling. But as I mentioned last time, even though many mental health disorders have as their criteria included sleep disturbance. And the notion is, well, if you treat the disturbance, then your sleep will improve. It's also true just the opposite, that if you treat the sleep and that improves, sometimes the sleep, the mental health issue goes away. So we talked about that. We talked about sleep and exercise and nutrition. And then I said that the bulk of this week, we would be talking about coping skills, because really, if you cope well and you have a lot of coping skills and a lot of tools in your toolbox, you're going to be able to manage stress. So before we go there, I wanted to clear up a couple of things, do some housekeeping from last week at the questions at the end. So one of the questions was in the area of food and nutrition, I talked about three reasons why we eat. And Judith Matz, who was my source on this, again, is not talking about, as it says, if you want to talk about benefits to the body, you can Google that. This is about our relationship with food. And she gave three reasons. And I wanted to clarify that because a couple of questions came up afterwards about it. Satisfy hunger is obvious. The second one, last week I said for pleasure. And I wanted to specify that more clearly this time. It's to enjoy the taste and the flavors and aromas, all that part. That's the second reason. Not pleasure in the more generic sense, because Ted and I talked about the fact that when you go to Europe, they have a sort of a different context for eating, and that meals are much more a social time when you sit and enjoy one another and extend it. And we tend to be very quick eaters, and out we go. So I wanted to clarify that, yes, there's lots of pleasure in having a meal together. And it's even an image that's used in scripture to talk about heaven, a banquet. So we know that there's pleasure that way. But I was talking specifically about taste, flavors, and aromas. And then the third one was for emotional comfort. So when she talked about these three, the first two are natural and appropriate, but emotional eating is a way that we suppress or soothe negative feelings such as loneliness, anger, worry, sadness, frustration, grief, and sometimes even boredom. The problem with that, it's temporary. When you eat for emotional reasons, when you're done eating and the pleasure's over, the emotional issue is still there. And actually it gets complicated because now you feel bad that you ate to soothe yourself, and you're feeling a little worse. So attuned eating is trying to address those first two and saying, yeah, let's focus on eating just for hunger and eating on that second point of what you're hungry for. But it also alerts us when we're eating for emotional reasons. So the key for Judith Matz is we're trying to learn to eat from the inside out. We're trying to pay attention to the inner issues, the inner indicators, and not external rules to diet, because those just generally don't work. So the three steps again are to learn to recognize when you're physically hungry, to know what that feels like, to know what you're hungry for, try to match that with the foods that'll satisfy you. Pay attention to fullness. Give yourself maybe 5-10 minutes after that first portion before you decide for a second portion. And you're going to have a more satisfying relationship with food. Okay, so that gets us past the housekeeping piece. Stress, mental health management. Mental health goes hand in hand with stress management. Stress, we all experience it. Back in the 60s, a couple of psychiatrists did some studies and decided to put together a scale that would help us understand what things are more or less stressful in our lives. And there were 43 areas that they defined, and I just listed the first 15 there. They had a somewhat arbitrary way to weight them. It's rather interesting that those last three all are weighted the same: sexual difficulties, gaining a new family member, and business readjustments are all a 39. When I looked further into this, years ago, I discovered that there was a little bit of question about the method for their arrival at these results. They actually studied 2,500 male sailors. And they studied them in regard to the prior 6 months having had stressful events. So they had to write down which stressful events they had had in the prior 6 months. And then they followed them for the next 6 months to see what kind of impact that had on them. So Clearly, there would be some questions about that. Would a male sailor react differently to imprisonment than a female in the Woodstock time? Pardon?
The message stays the same.
The message meaning? Yes, Chris, exactly. So the results and where this gets used, because you can still go online and take this and tell you what your score is on it. So the bottom line is that there wasn't a correlation, direct correlation, or a causal connection, but there was a meaningful connection. So that's exactly your point, that these events in your life clearly do have impact when it comes to stress. So how do we manage stress? Coping skills. How many coping skills do you have? Are they good, healthy coping skills? This is just the beginning list. That's why it says at the end, there are many more. And the ones that are checked are ones that we actually already talked about last week. And things that are self-care include these kind of coping skills. We talked about relaxation exercises, physical exercise, good nutrition, adequate sleep. Ed talked about expressing and sharing your feelings. We talked a little bit about gratitude, and Graham talked about prayer. So there are many more. And I wanted to talk about just a few of them, because to go into depth with all of them would take us well past our deadline. So the first one I want to talk about is the maintaining personal boundaries. We talk about porous boundaries, rigid boundaries, and permeable boundaries. So what I'd like to have you do is think of these first in terms of physical boundaries. So if you have property, or even in your yard at home, if you had a brick wall, a high brick wall that nobody could see over and nobody could get through, that would be a rigid boundary. If you had nothing around your yard, that would be a porous boundary. But if you had a chain link fence with a couple of gates, you would have a permeable boundary. People could see through it, but they couldn't get in just anywhere, and they'd have to go through gates. This is important because this same notion is true in our relationships with people. And you'll identify with some of these more or less. So in the porous boundaries, you're identifying someone who overshares personal information. That's when you're listening to someone in this situation, you're saying to them, TMI, quite frequently, right? They have difficulty saying no to the requests of others. It's just they kind of constantly are responding to everyone's requests. Over-involved in other people's problems. Dependent, overly dependent, I would say, on the opinions of others. So it's too important that you approve what I'm doing and what I'm saying. Tolerant of disrespect or abuse. Instead of being able to draw a boundary and say, no, I will not accept that. That was wrong and you need to stop. They have trouble being able to say no to being treated poorly. And complying with others just to avoid rejection. Like, I'm going to do what you say, and I'm going to follow what you're asking me to do, because I'm afraid that if I don't, you're going to reject me. A person with rigid boundaries avoids intimacy and close relationships. This is the person that would say, yeah, I kind of keep things very close to the vest. Unlikely to ask for help. I can do it myself. It ends up leaving a few close relationships. it's hard to get close to this person. And they want it that way. Very protective, overprotective. Now, personal information these days, we're all concerned about that in the technological circles. But I'm talking about sharing personal information. They would be very, very protective. Let very few people in on that. They can be detached even from the romantic partner. So I would not infrequently end up talking to couples where one partner says, I just can't get close to my spouse. I just feel like a detachment. And then just keeping others at a distance, again, ironically, to avoid rejection. So the person with no boundaries is avoiding rejection by complying. This person keeps others at a distance to avoid rejection. And then the permeable boundaries would be, obviously, a more healthy state. Valuing the opinions of others. I'd like to hear what you say, and I think I can learn from that. But I'm not dependent on them, and I'm going to make my decisions on my own. I don't compromise my values for the sake of others. I have beliefs and convictions, and I'm not going to give those away just to make you happy. I share my personal information at an appropriate level. So there's still people that I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about myself and a lot of personal details because I'm not in that kind of relationship with you. Other people, yes, I'm going to be sharing with you more about my life because you're a family member or you're my spouse or you're my best friend. Aware of personal needs, my own personal needs, and I can communicate them. I can tell you what I need. Again, in the counseling setting, sometimes that'll be an issue where one spouse will say, I just don't know what my partner needs. He or she doesn't express. And so there's a gap there. And finally, person with permeable boundaries, they can accept when others say no to them. I'd like to make a request. No. Okay. I can accept that. Let's move on. So these are healthy boundaries, this last section. And to the extent that we're in one of those first two categories, we can bring about change. It's not like this is a permanent condition, right? This isn't a medical diagnosis. These boundaries can change. And so that is one of our goals in self-care, again, is to build up our coping skills. And so this is one coping skill, is to be able to manage our boundaries, to have a good sense of boundaries. Any questions on that? Or okay. Let's talk a little bit about another coping skill, which is time management. If we think about the stresses of our life, especially in contemporary society, we are usually overwhelmed with demands on us. And being able to organize that is a key coping skill. I picked these three just because they're easy to remember if you look at the first letter. PSO, Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. No, yes. So prioritizing, scheduling, and organizing. When we prioritize, for many, many years, they used to, if you go to a time management seminar, they would talk about first, second, and third priorities. So people would struggle with, okay, my family's first, and then God. No, God has to be first, so then my family, and then my work. No, work, well, I have to get to work. And that whole sequential thing would put pressure on people all the time. Like, what's my first priority? So what we learned, obviously, is over the years that parallel priorities make much more sense. There's always going to be a first priority in all of these categories. And you just have to know when to respond to that one. So when it's time to go to work, you go to work because that's the first priority of the day. You don't say, well, you know what? My spiritual life is actually my top priority. So I'm just going to spend a little bit more time in prayer. I'm sure my boss will understand. Or when there's in your family, it's time to take a son or daughter to an academic event, a sporting event. That's the most important thing, to be there for your child. And so that's the number one priority. So you can use a grid like this and write under each column what the first, second, and third priority is for each of these. It's usually not worth going further than that. I mean, pretty much the first couple in each column are the ones that make the most sense. So parallel priorities, being able to prioritize the different aspects of your life is an important coping skill. Scheduling, this used to be in years past, the things that you did with a day timer, a paper and pencil calendar. And now we have very many options in apps on our phones. I actually looked at a couple online to see what the top rated ones were currently. So I don't know if any of you guys have these. They mentioned Rescue Time. Does anybody use Rescue Time? Anybody on the Zoom use Rescue Time? That one actually can send you reports on the things that are stealing your time, but you have to pay $6.50 a month for that subscription. Remember the Milk. Anybody use Remember the Milk? This is a free one, and it syncs to all your devices. So it's just basically a glorified calendar, a to-do list kind of thing. But Focus Keeper was the third one. Anybody? They said this one is great for procrastinators because it has special tips for procrastinators. So having an updated calendar, some kind of format that you use to have things that you know you need to participate in is important. However, the second piece is more important. You can have all that stuff in your calendar, but if you're not looking at it and actually updating it daily, you're going to run into trouble. Years and years ago, my wife and I set a Sunday night time, and we still do it, even though the children are long gone and have their own families. We still do a Sunday night planning where we both have our calendars and we look at what's coming up for the week and we decide who's doing what. And we make sure that we're aware of things so that there's not that, I had no idea you were going to be out last night. And so we do all that together and then update because it changes on a daily basis. So it's a simple exercise and discipline, but honestly, it's paid great dividends for us. So having a planning time is very important. Organization. It's one thing to have our life scheduled, but what about organizing things that are in that whole area of to-do lists? As I think I mentioned in my introduction last week, I've had kind of three different careers in administration. I did pastoral administration for a number of years, about 12 years. I did higher education administration for about 11 years, and then social service administration for 12 years. And when you do all that administration, you're exposed to every possible technique and tip for organizing. And the one that I found most practical was to have three action files. And in this case, it's not electronic. It was literally, this is for most of my career, I would just have a file folder and there would be three slots in my, whatever the organizer was. And the top file had immediate action. So anything that had to be done by the end of the day got put in that folder. Anything that had a deadline, not necessarily that day, would go in the second folder. And then anything that was in the rest would get the whenever I get to it. And simply being able to put letters, requests, deadlines, reports, anything to just be able to organize them in those three areas was the most effective thing I found. So being able to organize our files, organize our activities is very important. The third coping skill that I wanted to talk about is humor. Yes, Ted.
So I had a question about the organizing thing.
Yeah.
And I hear a lot of people who try to be as wise as you are say that if we want to maintain our focus, we need to shut down some of our screens and our phones and close the 20 open windows that we have on our computer, because all of that electronica has the tendency to steal our focus from us.
Hmm.
Any observations you'd care to offer on that?
I mean, I think it depends on the individual, because there, I do believe there are folks that can have that and not be distracted by it. But I think that that idea of feeling like you have to have everything at your fingertips can definitely be an unnecessary stressor. In fact, it reminded me when you said that last week, there was a question about the use of cell phones and iPads in bed before you're going to bed. My only answer was, I know that blue light is bad. And that was my answer. So I decided it wouldn't hurt to add something that's a little more helpful. And so I pulled this out. Harvard Medical School Publishing says this about that. Blue wavelengths, which are beneficial during the daylight hours because they boost attention, reaction times, and mood, seem to be the most disruptive at night. Exposure to light suppresses the secretion of melatonin, a hormone that influences circadian rhythms. So obviously that would be a problem at night. While any kind of light can suppress the secretion of melatonin, blue light at night does so more powerfully. And so it suggests that you avoid looking at bright screens beginning 2 to 3 hours before bed. That sounds a little restrictive. If you work at night shift and use a lot of electronic devices at night, consider wearing blue blocking glasses. There are such things. And then expose yourself to lots of bright light during the day, which will boost your ability to sleep at night, as well as your mood and alertness during the day. So that's why blue light is a problem. And out of all the parts of the spectrum, blue light is the one that's most disruptive to sleep. So anyhow, to Ted's point, the question of screens and all that, I would say depends on the person's temperament and approach to things. Any other questions? Sure, absolutely. And the setting that you find yourself in, are you talking about being in a very private, quiet place where you have all these things in front of you, or are you in a place that's also got all kinds of noise and disruption, which would only magnify it? All right. This is one of those screens, like I said last time, that I don't expect you to read. It's kind of small. It will be more beneficial in the note-taking. You don't have to take notes. This will be in the PowerPoint that you'll get a copy of. And by the way, we did, from last week, we do have last week's that will be going out, right, Ted?
Yes, I have to apologize. It's not posted yet. My spam folder got in the way of that, but it will be posted on Monday.
Okay, great. All right, so humor. Why is humor an important coping skill? Well, this also comes from, where does this come from? I think this was Mayo Clinic. But short-term and long-term benefits. Just laughing has a positive impact on your physical body. Laughter enhances your intake of oxygen-rich air, stimulates your heart, lungs, and muscles, and increases the endorphins that are released by your brain. It activates and relieves your stress response. So when you're laughing, it fires up and then cools down your stress response and it can increase and decrease your heart rate and blood pressure. Result is a good relaxed feeling, and it can soothe tension. Laughter can stimulate circulation and aid muscle relaxation, both of which help reduce some of the physical symptoms of stress. So this is along the same lines of what we talked about with diaphragmatic breathing and the progressive muscle relaxation. Those same types of results come from that. So I have to say, my youngest son, I forget if I mentioned this last week, but our youngest son has Down syndrome. He was just 25 on Friday. And he produces more moments of laughter and de-stressing than any other aspect of our life. He's a great blessing. So I can attest to this firsthand. The long-term effects of laughter: improving your immune system, that's a plus. Relieving pain. Laughter can actually ease pain by causing the body to produce its own natural painkillers. Increasing personal satisfaction, obviously, makes it easier to cope. And finally, improving your mood. So humor itself isn't just, I wish life was more fun. Putting yourself in situations where you can enjoy a good comedy, spending time with people that make you laugh. There are such people. I know that my college roommates and I get together once a year, and my wife wants to make sure that she's not present when we do that, because she said, all you do is laugh like idiots. So, and that's true. We can make each other laugh. So a good coping skill. So this is all to say that there are so many ways that are important to be aware of that you have as coping skills, because life is so stressful. On the flip side of that, I find that in my work with folks in therapy, very often some of the issues that come up are rooted in the fact that they have very, very limited coping skills that are actually anchored in developmental stages, early childhood years. So think about this. If you're 6 or 7 years old and you have a very disruptive family life, the home environment is chaotic and unpredictable, and you don't know when dad's going to get mad. You don't know when there's going to be somebody that leaves the house, and you don't know if they're coming back. So that kind of environment, what coping skills do you have at 6 and 7? Go hide in the closet, run away, shut down, or figure things must be bad because I did something wrong. Like, this wouldn't be like this, so it must be me. So when you have such few coping skills and you begin to use those to get through those developmental years and no one teaches you other ones, guess what? They stay, those persist, and you're using the same types of things in your adult life. So you're denying, avoiding, escaping. And that's what you're doing in the face of difficulty and stress instead of something more healthy. Even addictions are coping skills. There's, you know, many, many years ago, we talked about addictions as just brain dysfunction or the disease model only and so forth. But we've also found in more recent years a lot of validity in the idea that addictions are coping skills. They're just poor coping skills because they end up helping us get through painful situations. They numb us against things that we can't avoid, and we end up in that quandary. So part of self-care, part of mental health, part of being able to manage our lives better is to recognize the ones that the coping skills that are harmful and that are they're working against us, and to replace them with healthy coping skills. So how do you know if you're really taking good care of yourself? How do you know whether you're on the one end neglecting yourself or on the other side indulging yourself? Like, is there some scale that you can take, some assessment? Do you just ask a little bird to tell you? How are you going to know? So I would like to present to you the use of Johari's window. What is Johari's window? A couple of psychologists back in the 50s came up with a model that was derived from their group dynamics at the University of California. They called it Johari. They combined their first names, Joe Luft and Harry Ingham. Joe Harry. It's a model for enhanced communication and feedback. So what is Johari's window? So if you picture this as a window with four panes, and the horizontal axis is things that you know about yourself. The vertical axis is things that others know about you. So if you combine those in the first quadrant, that's the part that says open and free. That's stuff that you know about yourself and everybody else, or at least others know about you too. That's shared information. I know Tom's always late for meetings. I know that Susie is a talker and that she's going to dominate the conversation. Whatever it is, those are things that Susie knows about herself, that Tom knows about himself, and everybody else does too, those that know him. If you drop down to the third quadrant, it says the hidden area. Those are things that you know about yourself, but others don't. And so how does that change? How does that grow? You have to self-disclose. You have to be able to share with others. This gets into what Ed was talking about, sharing feelings, sharing expressions, but also sharing information appropriately, not TMI, but appropriately with people so that they get to know you better, if they need to know you better, if your spouse wants to know you better. This is something that's in your hands to disclose more about yourself. And so as you disclose more, express more, share more about your needs, people get to know you better. That's usually a very healthy and good thing. The next one is the top right, the second area that is called the blind area, or that's where our blind spots are. That's stuff that other people know about you, but you don't know about yourself. So by self-definition, you're not going to be able to discover this. The definition of a blind spot is that you can't see it. How do you get this to grow? You listen to others, right? You ask other people. You're open to feedback. You're able to hear people when they say, "Can I tell you something? Can I talk to you about this?" You know, when you are so abrupt with people, it turns them off. It pushes them away. You got to be a better listener. It feels like that when we're telling you something, you're already thinking of what you're going to say and you just jump in, or sometimes you even interrupt. Really? I do that? Yeah. I wasn't aware of that. That's why it's a blind spot. So as you listen to others and get feedback, your self-discovery, your self-awareness grows, and that's always a good thing. You can be aware of things that are hurting you. It can also, though, be a positive thing when people are telling you things about yourself that are good and strengths that you just kind of weren't connected to. Really? Yeah, you're a good listener. You really are. I mean, lots of people go to you because you pay attention. So growing in that area helps us grow in our awareness. And then the last quadrant are things that are unknown to us and unknown to others. So I always like to call this area, this is the part that only God knows. And we may never know fully about this area, but as the other two grow, as the hidden area and the blind area grow, then those dotted lines move and there's less area there that's unknown to everybody. So this is just sort of a way of picturing growth, self-awareness, and insight, which answers that earlier question, how do we know if we're taking care of ourselves? How do we know if we're in a good place? This interaction with others. We need other people in our lives. We need healthy relationships. We need communication on a regular basis. So the last question on this whole area was, well, then when do I need professional help? When should I stop just using my coping skills or feel like they've run out? And this is a multiple choice question. Is it A, when everything else fails and you're desperate? B, to get your friend to stop suggesting and pushing it? C, when your spouse gives you an ultimatum? Or D, when you need assistance until you're able to do it on your own, that is to say, to be your own counselor? What answer would you say is the right answer? D, very good. Although I certainly have people come to counseling for the first three, it's just not the best way to start. So when we become aware that, yeah, my resources are spent, I feel like everything I've tried is not working. So I need somebody to help me at this point. And that is the goal then of therapy. It's a partnership. The therapist and you are working together. He or she is giving you skills, equipping you with techniques and ways that you can then adopt, embrace, make your own, so that, as I said, you become your own counselor. And that's when I talk to the folks in my sessions, we talk about goals, you know, what are your treatment goals? And I always say, how will you know if this is working? Like, how do you know if this is benefiting you? Because we don't want to spend time and money if this isn't working. And usually they'll be able to come up with something that's a measurable thing to say, well, if I can sleep at night, or if I can learn conflict resolution skills so that I'm getting along better with my neighbor or my best friend or my son or daughter, then I'll know we're making progress. So that is a very concrete thing that we can say, okay, so when you get to that point, you might be then ready to be your own counselor and move on. Yes?
So what portion of your clients are?
I would say, boy, that's a hard thing to estimate. I'll say about a third. So it's clearly not the majority. Yeah. Okay.
What was the question?
Oh, the question was, how many of my clients are in category D, come into counseling with the fourth option? And I said about a third. Okay, so let's open it up to questions and clarifications, comments, complaints. Yes. He's getting the microphone because I guess that way we don't have to repeat the question.
Sort of a different subject, but where does the issue of mood swings come in? It's almost like a, you know, road rage type thing. One day you'll drive down the road and someone cuts you out. Oh, that's fine. Let them in. You wave them in. The next, for no reason, the next day you're ready to smash them off the road and those kind of things.
Yeah.
How does mood swings?
Yeah.
Fit into this whole thing.
So road rage. Oh, okay. Well, that gets us into my whole area of certification and anger management. The goal in anger management is always to find out what anger triggers there are, what we call them just trigger thoughts. And that's a hard thing to get to. But when you identify it, it can be a freeing thing because then you're not reacting anymore. So I'll give you an example. If somebody says to me, yeah, I get angry We do anger logs, like I mentioned last time. So they might say, yeah, I had an episode on Tuesday where my 12-year-old kind of gave me an attitude and I just, went off, just kind of screamed and yelled and lost control. So I said, well, what was the trigger thought? Well, that he was giving me an attitude. I said, no, that wasn't the trigger thought. So we explore more and we find out that, and I'm oversimplifying, but we get to a point where the trigger thought was, I am being dismissed. I am being thought little of. And that trigger thought was one that was planted in eighth grade when they were humiliated before the class or something. And for whatever reason, that stayed as a trigger that when people treat me like that, I just react. So it's more complicated than that, but that's what I would say is why one day something makes you angry and another way it doesn't. It's usually tied into a trigger thought.
It can be the same thing. One day you're happy as can be and the next day you're not.
Joy is a little different because we don't usually get triggered into joy. It's usually something that has a more clear connection to it, a causal thing. So I'm not sure how I would say that, why some days something makes you happy and another one doesn't. That's more unclear in my mind.
Is there, I wonder, an issue of emotional regulation that Chip is talking about?
Well, emotional regulation, right, is a different thing. The area of how I manage my feelings and find myself more, instead of like this, I find my emotions like this. Okay. If you're in this category, then we would definitely want to explore more sort of a similar thing, triggers that are creating that. And so yeah, emotional regulation is a goal in therapy when it's like this. Ted?
And then. I'm wondering about in coping skills, and it apologize if I scan past it in the list that you provided. Healthy relationships with a friend that actually, a friend who is actually equipped or prepared to listen.
Yeah.
And if you have any observations about that as a resource.
Yeah, that's part of when we mentioned quickly about expressing your needs or expressing your feelings, that's obviously with a person. So having a meaningful friendship, somebody that you can confide in, somebody that you can share things with and feel like you're truly heard. Yeah, that's definitely a coping skill. You had something, didn't you? Uh-huh. Yes. So the question of regular meals and how that can help you cope with stress, definitely if it's managed right. So if you just eat three meals a day and it's going back to the question of, are you eating when you're hungry? Sometimes you don't need a big meal at lunch, and so, but the idea of getting nutrition on a regular basis, which is, I think is what you're saying, right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. True. And especially breakfast is a key meal. And so you're absolutely right. Even if you eat, and some people do this, very small amounts, maybe three or four times during the day without sitting down to a big meal. Accomplishes the same thing.
Younger people seem to think breakfast is not important. Their parents do think that it's important for children, but a lot of young teenagers, especially college students, they don't eat breakfast.
Anybody have thoughts on that one?
It turns out that people are wired to be breakfast skippers or breakfast eaters. And the cereal companies did research to say that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. It is the most important meal of the day for people who are wired to really need breakfast and feel hungry and deprived if they don't get it. There are actually people who don't get hungry until mid or late morning. And the research on that is, if you're hungry for breakfast, have it. And if you're not, don't. So that's something that there's a intense interest about. So I've read a whole lot about it.
And that goes back to Judith Matz's point, eat when you're hungry.
Exactly.
Questions from Zoom?
Yes, anybody online? Please jump in.
I have a question. How does a psychotropic medication fit into the use, mental health counseling?
Yeah, that question actually came up last week too about the use of medications or chemicals. There's definitely, because of, you can't avoid these messages if you're watching any TV. Every drug on earth gets promoted as the next best thing. And talk about mixed signals, right? You have in the background people walking around doing pleasant things and enjoying one another out in the park while they're describing side effects could include sudden death. And so the promotion of psychotropics and other medications is really prominent. So there is a tendency, I think, for folks to want to go there first. And I would say that that's probably not the place to start unless the symptoms are so severe. So, if I have a client and they are telling me, I have not gotten out of bed for 3 days. I cannot face life. I have no hope. I believe that there is nothing to live for. I haven't eaten in 2 days. Okay, medication is clearly going to be needed to address that. No amount of my coping skills that we talked about earlier are going to change that. So the answer to your question is it depends on the severity, but there's definitely a place for it.
I'm going to encourage more questions. I see we have one, but for right now, I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording and say thank you so much for an excellent series.